The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and it is so nice not to be competing with the NFL playoffs or the Super Bowl for a change. The thing that is most lacking for young people from underserved communities is opportunity. The kind of opportunity that is provided by Perskolis, a nonprofit organization that was founded in the South Bronx. And this evening, you will hear from their chief executive officer, Plinio Aiello, who tells us of their mission.
I think every staff member and board member in the organization believes that talent is ubiquitous. And as such, we know that there is incredible talent in communities that are often overlooked, disconnected communities. And our mission is to find those individuals and provide them with quality IT training so that they can move into successful and transformative IT careers.
And if you want to find an unfair fight, no better place to look than Housing Court, where it's landlord versus tenant. A nonprofit that is committed to evening up this playing field is justfix.nyc. And I will be joined by their co-founder and president, George Clement.
Historically, in New York City and in cities and states around the country, there is no right to legal representation for tenants in Housing Court. So what that ends up meaning is you observe courtrooms where over 90% of the tenants have no legal representation, and over 90% of the landlords are represented by a lawyer.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, February 10th. The endowments of more than 800 U.S. colleges and universities returned an average of 8.2% net of fees in the fiscal year that ended June 30th, 2018, a significant drop from the 12.2% recorded the previous year. 54% of charities raised more money in 2018 than they did in 2017, and 64% expect to raise more money this year than last, according to a new survey. Rwanda became the first low-income country to provide universal eye care to all of its citizens by training 3,000 nurses in over 500 health clinics. Charities may be waiting too long to get back in touch with potential donors they have provided services to, decreasing the likelihood of a gift, according to a recent study from Wharton. The Board of Trustees of Hampshire College announced last week that it would admit a much-reduced freshman class this fall, a sign of the increasingly perilous operating environment for small liberal arts colleges in challenging regions like the Northeast. And finally, a new Global Youth survey showed that young people in all countries are more optimistic than adults. 9 in 10 teenagers in Kenya, Mexico, China, Nigeria, and India reported feeling positive about their future. And that is a Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Plinio Aiello of Perskolis right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile? There's an organization headquartered in New York City that you need to know about. Over the past 23 years, it has helped change the lives of 9,000 individuals, mostly from overlooked communities, and has helped provide them a good career through tuition-free tech training. It's called Perskolis, and it's a pleasure to have with us here their president and CEO, Plinio Ayala. Good evening, Plinio, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about Perscolis and what the organization was created to do.
Yeah, I think every staff member and board member in the organization believes that talent is ubiquitous. And as such, we know that there is incredible talent in communities that are often overlooked, disconnected communities. And our mission is to find those individuals and provide them with quality IT training so that they can move into successful and transformative IT careers.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in the South Bronx, Plinio. It was during the 1970s and 1980s. And as I recall, that was a pretty tough time for New York City and even more so for the South Bronx. Tell us about that time for you and the influence it had on your current position.
It was a tough time. You know, as I reflect back on my days on Tremont Avenue and Southern Boulevard, it was a time when the borough was missing pockets of its community. People had left. Buildings were abandoned. And yet there was this sense of family still, this desire to want to do more with your life. And what I quickly realized was that people that had a job tended to do better.
Mm-hmm.
And so I quickly equated a job to something more. And that's really had an impact on me as an adult, right? Sort of how do you build these opportunities for individuals so that they can go out and live meaningful lives, be gainfully employed, be able to support their families? When I saw that growing up, in those few instances that it happened, it was quite transformative.
Yeah. Even in your own family, as you said, when your dad was working, things were pretty good. And when he wasn't,
Not exactly right.
Yeah. So it wasn't a lack of will. It was really a lack of opportunity.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I think, we see thousands of people every year, and it's never really an issue of talent. These individuals are super smart, super gifted, highly gritty, with tremendous amount of motivation. What's missing in those communities is often that opportunity.
So how did Perscolis get started, and how did it materialize as a nonprofit organization?
You know, we originally had the mission of bridging the digital divide, specifically in the South Bronx, with the recognition that there was this technology chasm between the haves and have-nots, right? So if you could afford a brand new computer, you were likely to enter the digital age. And if you couldn't pay that $4,000 cost for a PC,
that's what it was,
right? You were not. And so we founded the organization with the intention of rebuilding used computers,
mm-hmm,
and getting them back out into the hands of people that couldn't afford the new ones. But as we were doing that, and by the way, at its peak, we were producing 10,000 computers a year and connected about 100,000 families during that period of time for the organization. But we had to find people in the community to fix these computers. So we found six, we trained all six, and within 6 months they left us. And when we started poking around as to the why that happened, you know, it was clear they now had a skill that translated to a lot more money. And that's when we realized that there could be a real unique opportunity in training folks and moving the needle around economic equity.
You were on to something.
We were.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to talk about the program in a second, but how do you determine who gets to enroll in Perscolis?
Yeah, we have a very robust assessment and recruitment process. So someone has to come in and spend basically a day with us where they have to complete a number of assessment tools. We test for reading and math levels. People have to be at the 10th grade in both.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to have a high school diploma. And they've got to have this willingness or inclination to want to be a technologist. And we assess that through a number of tools that we implement during that day activity with that student.
Mm-hmm. And give us a snapshot of your student population in terms of race and gender and age.
Yeah, so 35% of our students are youth between the ages of 18 and 25. 30% are women, and we're really proud of that. We're trying to grow that number. As you know, that percentage in the corporate community is very, very low. So 30% are women, and 90% are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, you know, we see five people for every one person we select. And so this is quite a selective process to get into the program.
Yeah, tougher than most colleges, as a matter of fact. You know, a 20% acceptance rate. These courses are roughly 15 weeks or so, give or take. What specifically are these courses in, and what's it like for an enrollee to spend 3 or 4 months with you?
Well, the courses really are driven by what our corporate partners say they need talent in, right? And so we're very in tune in sort of understanding what the corporate community is needing as far as IT talent is concerned. And then we take that information and we can build curriculum that can train people for those skills that are relevant today. And it'll range anywhere from IT support. These are the folks that'll go in and set up your network or fix your computer when it's down, to software testing, software development. It's really a very interesting group of courses that we've developed, but all of them have really been created with employers in mind.
How do you work with these employers? I mean, what's the process? Do they come in? Do you meet with them? How do you communicate in terms of finding out what they need today?
You know, it's taken us a long time, Denver, to build the infrastructure to be able to create these really meaningful relationships with employers. But I think we're there. We have been able to develop the expertise to go out and meet with members of the corporate community and ask very pointed questions around what their talent gaps are, and then use that information in collaboration with them to build curriculum so that we can go find people in overlooked communities, train them up, and provide this amazing pipeline of talent for these corporations to consume.
In addition to the technical training, do you do anything around life skills and things of that sort that these people are going to be able to succeed in the workplace?
Absolutely. So you asked a question about the experience of a student at Proskolis. The training is incredibly comprehensive. So along with the technical skills training, we provide extensive soft skills development. We provide job placement at the conclusion of the training. And more importantly, I think we provide this wraparound set of services that allows individuals to continue to get assistance from us while they're in training and 2 years post-training, so that we can make sure that the footing for our students remains solid after they leave us.
Talk a little bit more about those soft skills. How much time do you dedicate to that, and what are the ones that the students seem to really need to work on?
About 20% of our training is dedicated to soft skills.
Like a day a week.
A day a week, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we tend to ask our students to know what they don't know. And if they've never been given soft skills training, then they're deficient in a number of areas that might preclude them from getting a job, right? So how do you interview? How do you fill out an application? How do you get ready for that experience in the workplace? But it's much more in depth than the cursory sort of resume writing class that you might take in one of these courses. It's really building additional skill sets that allow individuals to be successful once they're on the job. How do you negotiate a raise with your boss? How do you work in a team setting? How do you write a proper email to your supervisor? All those life skills, those soft skills are covered in our training.
Mm-hmm. Do most of the people who start the program Plenio go on to complete it?
About 85% of our folks graduate from the program, and a similar percentage end up in jobs. You know, and I think what's impressive about that number is that we don't believe in social promotion. So you've got to meet certain standards within the program. You have to have a 70% grade point average. You can't be absent more than twice or you're automatically dropped from the program. And so people rise to those expectations. And I think for us, if we're graduating you, there's an implied promise for the graduate and for the employer that they're ready for the work for the workplace.
You know, you talked about the employers there. How many jobs in the American economy would you say are open right now that require the kind of skills that you train for?
Well, I'm going to step back for a second. If you recall, when the Great Recession hit in 2008, there are about 3 million jobs in this country that went unfilled. Seems so counterintuitive. So many millions of Americans out of work.
Sure does.
In IT, we project that number to be very similar by 2020, right? So there'll be millions of jobs open in the IT sector in the next several years because we're not producing enough talent in our system to satisfy the growth needs of our corporations.
Mm-hmm. You said 85% of your graduates go on to find jobs. Now, how do you help them in this regard? And what is the more or less starting average salary for these graduates?
So we have members on staff that have outstanding relationships with our corporate partners. And in essence, we are getting information, real-time information from these corporations saying, look, I need 3 software testers, I need 2 Java developers, I need 3 IT support folks. And we will go through the graduating class and identify the right individuals for that corporation and place them in that job. And the average salaries for our students are about $40,000 to start. And when you consider, Denver, that prior to our training program, they're earning less than $10,000.
Wow.
That's a 400% increase in
impressive.
Their earnings mm-hmm. in less than 15 weeks.
Very impressive. You know, you were talking about the need for IT jobs. Well, one area that I know that the corporate marketplace is really in urgent need of talent is around cybersecurity. As a matter of fact, I've read that they're estimating another 1.5 million or 2 million jobs are going to open up in the next couple years. You started a partnership with Barclays Bank a couple years ago. Tell us about that and how that is growing, that area.
I think the partnership with Barclays Bank exemplifies how we can work with employers. You know, there's no secret. You kind of read a story a day about a corporation's security being compromised. And so there is this huge need of cybersecurity experts to be able to protect our information. And so we were able to work with Barclays to create a customized training curriculum in partnership with their security folks, in partnership with many of their vendors, to really tackle this issue of dearth of cybersecurity talent. And we've produced upwards of a couple of hundred people already, all going into these jobs. In that training track, the starting average salary is about $60,000, $65,000 a year.
Yeah, these are good jobs, and I think that's something that people have to appreciate. And not only is the starting salary good, but their chances of really increasing that fairly quickly are very much alive.
It's significant. When you think about this chasm between the haves and the have-nots just growing in this country. In many ways, we're rebuilding the middle class, right? When you can land a job making $60,000, $65,000 a year to start and then see that salary increase over time, you are transforming not just the life of the individual that graduate, but you're also transforming the lives of family members, rebuilding communities.
Yeah.
It truly is transformative.
Yeah, ripples.
Yep.
Perskolas has a well-earned reputation for advanced data gathering. You've done that actually right from the very start. How has that helped advance your work and propel the organization forward?
I think, you know, when we take someone's donation, there's this overwhelming need to return as much as we can, right, for that grant, for that support. And I think where we've been able to do that is by, as you've mentioned, be very thoughtful about how we use data. We collect all types of data points to ensure that the program continues to function and perform at the highest of levels. If it's not, we can course correct really quickly because we have the data in place. We know where to recruit. We know what employers to work with. We know where our students are, how much they're earning. All of that information is incredibly important and informs how we continue to modify and adjust the program to be as successful as we can for the people that we're serving, but also for the investors who are providing support to the organization.
You've also done a couple of randomized control trials.
We have.
Oh, my goodness. tell us quickly what those are, and also tell me, Plenio, the stress that can put on an organization when you're continuing to do your day-to-day work.
It is the gold standard of evaluations, right? The medical industry does it all the time with sort of drug testing. You have placebos, and then you have people that are actually taking the drug, and then they get evaluated over time. Both studies required us to train, actually recruit twice the number of people that we could train. Half went into a control group, half into the treatment group, and then both cohorts were evaluated over time. Both reports indicated by a lot in almost every category that the people that went to our training program did better, landed better jobs, earned more money, were able to acquire benefits, to express satisfaction with life and the job at higher rates than those that did not. It was incredibly important for us to do it, not just once, and people thought I was crazy when I decided to go ahead and did it the second time, because it does require the organization to bend a little bit.
Yeah.
It creates stress points that you didn't realize would be created over time. People had to adjust to this new way of doing business. You know, there was this morality that we had to deal with. How do you turn people away, right? This is not what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But we thought for the sake of the field and proving that workforce development, at least this model worked, was incredibly important going forward. We decided to do that. But it wasn't without pain.
Yeah, I bet. What communities are you in currently around the country?
Well, we were founded in the South Bronx. In New York, we've opened an office in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And then we began our expansion strategy in 2012, landed in Columbus, proceeded to open an operation in Cincinnati, then Silver Spring, Maryland, right outside of D.C., Dallas, Atlanta. And then this year, we will launch offices in Boston and in Newark.
Mm-hmm. And you also have recently announced a $31 million growth capital campaign. What do you hope to achieve with that campaign, and who are some of your early supporters?
Yeah, the growth strategy campaign. So, you know, we just to give you some context, right, when we first started the organization and this training initiative, we trained a half dozen folks and have grown that very deliberately and intentionally over the last 20-some-odd years, where we trained 1,600 people last year. And
how many in total since you were founded?
About 9,000.
9,000.
Mm-hmm. But we need to do more.
Yeah.
There are many more people that could benefit from this program. And so this catalytic funding that we are pursuing will allow us to grow pretty significantly. So there are three main goals that I think we want to accomplish with this plan. The first is to grow our service level from 1,600 last year to 4,000 by 2023.
That's a bold vision.
It's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge, but quite doable. And it'll be 4,000 people every year going forward after 2023, and we're really excited about that. And we think that that number is going to be big enough to really foster equity and diversity in the tech sector, right? Sort of our second goal. How do you change the face of technology in the corporate community? And then the last piece, which I think could be transformative for the field, is how do you redefine scalability and sustainability? Mm. Let me just spend 30 seconds on that.
Please do.
You know, we have been able over time, and I talked about sort of building the capacity to work with employers in a very meaningful way. The value proposition that we provide employers is significant and growing every day. And they have recognized that it is a business imperative to invest in an organization like Prescolis, because we're creating this meaningful pipeline of talent that they absolutely can consume and need. And so we are creating these customized models. So you can come to me, Denver, with your corporation and say, I need 100 Java developers. And we will sit together and create a curriculum. And then I'll go find the people in the community, train them, and then make them available to you. And corporations are beginning to pay, covering the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so that diversification of funding for us is going to be incredibly important to allow us to meet the scale numbers that we are seeking to achieve.
Yeah, it really is a wonderful model. It's very similar to what YearUp does. And places like that where it's really not charity. It is an investment on the part of corporations, and they pay to get this kind of pipeline of talent because they know what it does to strengthen their company.
Makes great business sense, doesn't it?
It really does. No, and you also, I think, to scale in these days, you need an earned income model. You just can't do it on the back of philanthropists alone.
That's correct. And we've been dependent on the largesse of foundations and corporations, but that can only take you so far. And I think this additional piece to our model is going to move us on a very, very fast trajectory to grow the program.
Let me ask you a little bit about your workplace culture at Prescolis. What do you believe is the most outstanding aspect of it, which both attracts talent to work there and keeps them there?
I think we are true to our mission. And let me step back and define that a little bit. I think there are many organizations that try to do too many things,
mm-hmm.
And I think over time they dilute their effectiveness. We are an IT training organization. That's what we've been, and that's what we will continue to do. And you can see the transformation that we're having in the lives of folks because they come back to us and they share their stories. Let me share one with you.
Please, I was going to ask you.
I was lucky enough to meet this young woman in Dallas named Tara Fuller a couple of years ago, and she shared with me that prior to entering our program, she had lost her job. Mm-hmm. And she was having a real tough time entering the workplace again, and she had found some part-time work, and she was a mother of five trying to support her family, and it just wasn't enough. And even though she was able to access some benefits, all of that added together wasn't enough to cover her costs. She eventually lost her home, became homeless, had to move in with her mother, found our program, completed the training, got her certifications, fast forward. She's gotten three promotions since she landed her first job 2 weeks out of training. She's moved out of her mom's home. She has bought her own home. It's a tremendous story. And so when we think about the $31 million that we're seeking, what's the return on that money? Mm-hmm. Well, when we look at the cumulative wages of our students over that five-year plan, it's close to $500 million that people will be earning every year. But when you add on top of that the savings to the system.
Right, going off of public assistance.
Exactly. Yeah. We're talking about huge, huge return to our economy. And that's exactly what happened with Tara and what happens with all of our students every single year. And so when our staff sees that, they're incredibly motivated to continue to do the good work that we're doing.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to see the impact of what you're doing. And what you said a moment ago about staying true to your mission, I've also noticed that's a wonderful way in an organization to avoid burnout. It's those organizations that try to take on too many things that you just wear your people out. But when you stay disciplined like that, they can have a decent work-life balance and be successful in their careers. Let me close with this, Plinio. I know that you have worked with the mayor's office on re-envisioning the New York City workforce system. But let's take a look at this from a national perspective for a moment. How do you think the way we're preparing young people for the future of work with robotics, the role of college education, et cetera, is going to change over the course of the next decade?
Denver, I think our schooling system in this nation has failed a great many. I think we have continued to push this post-secondary approach as the sort of silver bullet for many of our young people, only to find that we're not training people in the skills that they need to be able to enter the workforce right after graduating these colleges. They're ending up with tremendous debt. In many cases, they have to go out and get additional training to be able to get into work. And when you look at an organization like Proskolis, where a college degree is not necessary to be able to land a full-time, meaningful career in the IT sector, there's got to be a way of rethinking how we are developing our talent so that there are more options available to our young people. And we're not pigeonholing them into sort of just the college situation. And I'm not suggesting that college isn't important. I think it is very, very important for a segment of our population, but it doesn't have to be for all. And I think we're proving that every day through our program.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it seems to be something that we've intellectually got our arms around, but not emotionally yet. Still, we fall into that trap of you need to go to college, and that really is beginning to change. Well, Plinio Ayala, the president and CEO of Proskolis, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, what listeners will find there, and how they can help support this work if they're so inclined.
Denver, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. Yes, please visit www.perscholas.org, PERSCHOLAS.org, to learn more about our organization. We are a one-of-a-kind, evidence-driven, proven model that's having tremendous impact in communities across this country. and we would appreciate your ability to continue to support this organization. Thank you.
Well, you've convinced me.
All right, great.
Thanks, Plenty. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Babies sure don't come with manuals, and for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org. A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Around 1.2 million New Yorkers live in what qualifies as deficient housing. And in the battle between tenant and landlord that can ensue, the former has historically been at a severe disadvantage. But there's a young organization that, through technology, is helping to even the playing field and promoting housing justice. It's Just Fix NYC, and it's a pleasure to have with us their co-founder and president, George Clemon. Good evening, George, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thanks so much, Denver.
Tell us about the mission of Just Fix NYC and what the organization was created to do.
So Just Fix NYC has a mission of building data-driven tools for both individual tenants and advocates fighting displacement, currently focused on New York City.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were inspired and your co-founders by observing tenants, some of them with pretty good cases, but who were just not prepared for evictions court. What was lacking?
That's right. So historically, in New York City and in cities and states around the country, there is no right to legal representation for tenants in housing court.
Hmm.
So what that ends up meaning is you observe courtrooms where over 90% of the tenants have no legal representation and over 90% of the landlords are represented by a lawyer. So you have a courtroom with a layperson on one side and a lawyer on the other side, which when we look at the history of the justice system is not how it was meant to be built. It was meant to have lawyers on either side of the room arguing a case sort of on equal playing fields. And so what's ended up happening is in housing court in New York City, it's become sort of an eviction machine where you have this really severe imbalance between tenants and landlords. And what we observed through hundreds of hours of literally sitting in the back of courtrooms around New York City was individual tenants coming into the courtroom often with grocery bags filled with various documents, their lease and violation reports. And they would try to tell their story, to talk about what was going on in their apartment, what kind of issues they faced. And when judges would ask them to actually show them evidence of repairs that needed to be made, we actually saw a lot of tenants approach the judge's bench and start swiping through photos that they had taken on their phone.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge would say, you know, I see these issues, but I actually can't enter that as evidence. And so these tenants would be backed into these really, really bad negotiated agreements simply because they weren't presenting their case in this very formal, organized way.
Yeah.
And we saw at that moment this opportunity where there was this existing behavior of folks cataloging the issues that they were dealing with. They weren't thinking of it as gathering evidence in legal terms, but they were actually taking photos of the issues. And so our opportunity was, how can we help people formalize and organize this information in order to present it in this particular context?
And one question on that, why were their pictures on their phone inadmissible as evidence?
So there's a few things. One is they actually had to present things as printed out photos in court. And another thing that JustFix helps them do is actually pull out what's called the metadata of a photo, so the exact time, date, and location a photo was taken, to verify that this photo was taken in their apartment at this particular day.
Right.
The status quo, you had landlord's attorneys that were saying, oh, well, this isn't your apartment,
or yeah,
this is a photo from before we made repairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turned into this hearsay that ended up in tenants not getting the kind of results that they deserved.
So what did you do, George? You and your two co-founders are sitting in the back of the court, and you observe this, and you think there's a real opportunity and a real need here to be addressed. How did you go about starting?
So we took a very community-led approach and what's called human-centered design process.
Mm-hmm.
My co-founder, Dan, had actually been doing some volunteer tenant organizing with a group in Brooklyn called the Crown Heights Tenants Union.
Because he was living this problem, wasn't he?
He was living this problem, dealt with a lot of issues in his own apartment. You know, unfortunately, this is quite a universal problem in New York City, but is especially acute when you look at low-income renters with very little leverage in terms of being able to go find another apartment that they can pay for.
And that, not that it needs to be said, but obviously the incentive for landlords to evict these people is?
So oftentimes these are tenants that are living in rent-stabilized apartments, and so they actually don't have the option of bringing that rent-stabilized lease to another apartment. So their leases govern how much rent can increase every year. It's typically either no increase or 1 or 2% increase per year. And so these are very, very valuable leases and apartments to hold on to, and has become sort of the de facto affordable housing in New York.
Right.
And landlords therefore have this enormous incentive, financial incentive, to force those people out. And if they can get those folks out, they can raise the rent to market rate, which could be as much as 5x the monthly rent.
Yeah, yeah. So walk us through exactly how JustFix NYC, which is an app, how does it work?
So our tenant-facing services, we sort of refer to as, imagine, TurboTax for suing a slumlord.
Uh-huh.
So starting with helping tenants gather evidence in a very structured way, so doing a checklist of issues that they're dealing with in their apartment, which could be repairs, could be issues with their lease, not getting rent receipts, or being harassed in some way. And then they have a series of actions that they can take that escalate from simply reaching out directly to their landlord by sending a formal letter of complaint via certified mail, which is an important step in terms of proving, if they do go to court, that they did notify the landlord.
Mm-hmm.
Making sure folks are calling 311 and logging a complaint through the city and getting an inspector to their apartment. And this can also help in actually suing them in housing court. So actually creating the court filings necessary for what's called an HP action in housing court.
Mm-hmm.
An important additional piece is we want to get individual tenants in touch with the advocacy community whenever possible. So for particular cases, that means actually connecting with a legal aid provider and getting a free attorney. Oftentimes, this also means getting in touch with a tenant organizing group. So these are community-based grassroots groups that will help buildings with especially acute issues to put together a tenant association and start to take collective action. And obviously, collective action is an incredibly powerful lever in this system. And so whenever possible, we want to get people banding together with their neighbors who are oftentimes facing very similar issues.
Oh, I got you. So you have an ability then to aggregate all this information and then see patterns, whether it be in a building or maybe it even with a landlord who owns a number of different buildings. And then when you begin to identify those, you have more leverage in terms of trying to address the problem.
Absolutely. So from an individual standpoint, it means instead of taking what may feel like a very risky action by yourself, sort of going out on a limb and trying to fight for your rights.
Fight City Hall.
Exactly. Yeah. Just you against this landlord, or it feels like you against this big system. From an individual standpoint, it means now you're part of a group, and there's certainly a lot of safety and power that comes with being part of a larger group taking action.
Yeah.
In addition to that, tactically, this is actually very, very helpful in terms of filing group cases from a legal standpoint. Or, you know, tenant organizing has historically done things like rent strikes and using the power of a significant number of tenants in a building all, you know, joining together as a real point of leverage against a landlord who may not be so worried about one of their tenants, but is certainly worried about 50% of their tenants taking action together.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we always knew that at the point where we have thousands of tenants across the city reporting their issues, filing cases, that that would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We've now seen in about the past 9 to 12 months, really how that can be effective and powerful.
Yeah.
And so to your point, that means identifying trends across buildings, across neighborhoods, across the whole city, and identifying the worst landlords who have these patterns of neglect and harassment across their entire portfolios.
Is this a free app, and how do people find out about it?
So this is entirely free for individual tenants. They can go to justfix.nyc and create an account. So it is one of these .nyc websites that the city really likes but can confuse people sometimes. But yeah, justfix.nyc.
And how many households have you been able to serve since you were founded back in, what, 2015?
Yeah, so we sort of formally incorporated in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
We have served about 10,000 tenants across the city through our various services. And that means helping folks get repairs in their apartments, prevent evictions. And overall, our goal is preventing displacement.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great guidebook. You have the letters in there. You have the texts in there, the templates. It's really, you know, step by step. What language is this available in?
So right now, the primary tenant-facing service on justfix.nyc is available in English and Spanish. There is also a site called evictionfreenyc.org for tenants that are facing an eviction in order to find out if they are eligible for a free attorney through the new right to counsel law. It's also called universal access by the city, but this is a law in which income-eligible tenants that are facing an eviction in housing court can get a free attorney. And that's available in 5 languages at evictionfreenyc.org.
Is there a fine line, George, between what you do and giving legal advice, which presumably you're not allowed to do?
So there is a fine line. And anybody in the legal world will tell you that there is quite a gray area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that the legal aid providers deal with a lot as they try to think of more innovative ways to provide access to know your rights information and provide access to this kind of legal knowledge in a space where most people can't afford an attorney and legal aid providers are over capacity and can't represent everybody. And so luckily, you know, we are able to provide these kinds of tools in this sort of self-help context where the vast majority of tenants would be what's called pro se, which basically means representing themselves in court. And so there's sort of a lot more wiggle room in that area, given we know we're not competing against the Bar Association and attorneys that are going to represent those kinds of tenants because they don't have the means
don't
to
have the wherewithal
pay for
to do it.
An
yeah.
attorney.
What has the response been of the legal profession, the courts, to the evidence that has been produced as a result of the Just Fix NYC app?
So we started working with housing court judges and attorneys from the very beginning as part of our design process to make sure that whatever we were going to build would actually be useful and would move the needle in terms of helping tenants be successful. As you can imagine, judges prefer a case where tenants come in with this great documentation, printed out photos, a timeline of the
issues they've been dealing with, as opposed to a garbage bag,
as opposed to showing them photos on their phone and a grocery bag filled with different documents. So it's been very well received by judges, by attorneys who work with these tenants who have been using JustFix to sort of organize themselves through this process.
Who are some of the partner organizations that you work with?
So we work very closely with Legal Services NYC, Legal Aid Society, a lot of the large legal aid providers in New York, as well as an extensive network of community organizations across the city. We piloted our services with a group in the Southwest Bronx called CASA that does tenant organizing. And we really think it's important that these aren't just partners for distribution, but these partners have been critical from the very beginning in designing these services. So we follow this sort of methodology called build with, not for. And the basic premise is we don't know what we should be building, and we're not presenting people with solutions to problems, but instead, anything that we build has to be informed by the communities in which that we serve and the communities in which we operate.
Mm-hmm.
And so this network of partners has been really critical in gaining the trust of tenants across the city and making sure that what we build is actually going to be effective.
Yeah, you've done a lot of testing and a lot of feedback, and you keep on changing the product all the time, which you need to do to be responsive. So you maybe have touched on this a little bit, but what do you do when you encounter a situation which is too complicated to handle on the website alone?
So there are certainly cases that escalate to a point where a tenant really needs to access legal counsel.
Yeah.
When you think about the number of cases that get to a point of somebody sort of facing imminent eviction, that person needs to work with a lawyer right away. And so part of our partnerships with legal aid providers around the city also means flagging cases for them where the tenant should really be working with a lawyer. So once cases escalate to that point, we'll put them in touch with those legal advocates.
Yeah. Well, this is so encouraging to hear because I think we've all looked at the housing system as being too big, too complex, that you just can't touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that through technology, we're beginning to make a dent. Are you seeing other forms of technology that are being created to help impact the housing system of New York City?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, there are certainly some companies sort of on the for-profit side of things that are trying to sort of leverage technology in creating greater transparency in sort of the rental experience of finding a new apartment and having some sense of the quality of that building or that landlord. You know, for us, the tenants that we are working with don't have an option of what apartment to live in. And so that's, those products are focusing on sort of more sort of middle and upper income demographics. I think, when you look at housing in New York City, especially right now, but really across the country, you see a crisis in public housing. And
yeah.
In New York, NYCHA is in the headlines constantly. And that is a daunting problem. You look at they have about a $35 billion backlog of repairs, of capital improvements that need to be made. And that's because there are issues with the roofs and elevators that are broken. These are very expensive repairs to be made. Lead throughout the building, right. So real infrastructure problems. And that feels like a problem that can't be solved through an app, through technology, certainly. And so there are most definitely areas where we can use technology to address problems. But at the same time, there are very foundational issues here with, you know, defunding of public housing and that type of thing that are leading to a lot of the issues we see.
Well, you're a nonprofit organization, and I know one of the things you always wanted to do was make this free, this app free to anybody who wanted it. So what is your business model, your funders, and do you receive any government funding?
Sure. So our funding comes from foundations, from corporate philanthropy, smaller community funders as well. And in terms of government funding, we receive some funding, just discretionary funding from city council members and borough presidents. We don't have any government contracts. But, you know, we have been very, very lucky to have started this organization sort of coming out of the Blue Ridge Labs program at the Robin Hood Foundation. So this is basically an in-house technology incubator under the umbrella of the Robin Hood Foundation. So certainly a very, very novel concept in the foundation world. And it meant that from the beginning, we sort of had this backing of the Robin Hood Foundation, which has been really critical in getting other funders on board, as Robin Hood has this reputation of being a very difficult funder to break into. And so we've been very lucky in getting support for our work in New York.
Yeah. George, are there other similar apps in other cities across the country? And along those same lines, do you have plans to bring this app to other cities?
Yeah. So, you know, we spoke with folks in Chicago from a tenants union that built a product called Squared Away that was similarly helping tenants send emails or letters to their landlords and bringing some structure to those notices. We have spoken with a number of tenants unions, legal aid providers, city governments around the country in cities that are dealing with very similar issues of displacement and harassment from landlords, eviction crises, that type of thing. And we are very excited in 2019 to start to formalize those partnerships with groups around the country and see how we can start to replicate some of the tools that we've built in New York in other cities. And those conversations are really focused on what actually is needed in another city, as there are differences in you know, the legal process, certainly, and particular regulations. And so rather than saying what we've built is going to serve everyone everywhere, making sure that it's informed by the reality on the ground and that advocates in other cities are really driving the process of what would be developed and how JustFix might be helpful.
Yeah, yeah. And very much along the same lines of your thinking with getting the feedback here in New York City from your users, knowing you don't have all the answers. The answers are really in the communities that you're serving. You could fairly be described as a high-tech nonprofit looking to have outsized impact with a minimum of overhead and employees. What's it like working in an enterprise such as that, and how do you think it differs from your traditional bricks and mortar nonprofit organization?
Yeah, you know, it's very fun.
Sound like you're having fun.
Yeah, I certainly love working there, and I think our, you know, our team has this very interesting sort of cross-disciplinary or multidisciplinary background where we are bringing together folks with housing justice experience, folks with tenant organizing experience, and people coming from the tech world. And seeing that merge in our team and the incredible energy and excitement that both of those groups have to start working together in a dedicated way, full time, is really, really exciting. And it's amazing to see the people that are interested in joining Just Fix and get excited by the idea of getting to collaborate in that way on a daily basis. We are sort of, I would say we look a little bit more like a traditional tech startup than we do like a traditional nonprofit.
I would say so, yeah.
The way that we operate in the day to day, it's really a difference of where does our funding come from, who are the people that we serve, and you know, when I look at the difference between also how we are different than for-profit startups, you know, we have to compete over similar talent, but we have a very different sort of value proposition as an employer, obviously. So maybe we can't quite compete on salary or perks, but there are a lot of folks coming from the tech world that are very disillusioned with what the tech sector has become in the past few years and are looking for ways to work on something more meaningful. I also think Trump's election was a real call to action for a lot of folks. And so increasingly there's more interest in organizations that are sort of unique like us where they can apply their skills in a to a very particular sort of social justice cause.
Yeah. In looking at where you're at right now, sort of straddling the tech sector with the nonprofit sector, do you have any thoughts on how the nonprofit sector could operate more effectively and efficiently?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there is this culture of mergers and acquisitions, obviously, or process of mergers and acquisitions in the for-profit world that sees large corporations that acquire smaller startups that are building innovative technology because they want to update what they're doing and make sure that they're sort of staying ahead of trends. And it's not something that you see in the nonprofit world because acquisitions and mergers are simply not a practice in this sector. And if anything, the nonprofit world spends more time and energy on fundraising and the administrative side of things that can be really time-consuming and take up a lot of capacity for a small organization like ours. And I think there's a big opportunity for some of these more traditional nonprofits to leverage some of the innovation happening in sort of this burgeoning nonprofit tech startup world.
Interesting observation. Let me close with this, George. Share with us a story of a tenant who used the Just Fix NYC app and what occurred as a result.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a number of different stories I could tell. Tenants dealing with situations that you can't imagine people in New York City, in sort of the capital of the world, right, with such incredible wealth accumulation happening in the city that folks down the street are living in really, really dire situations and being mistreated significantly. So one tenant in particular is living in the South Bronx, rent-stabilized apartment, single mother with two young kids, and there was a really long-standing issue with water damage, and it started causing really bad black mold problem in the bathroom especially, such that one of her kids was developing asthma, and when you look at that problem sort of on a larger scale, asthma is the most prevalent chronic issue that kids face and disproportionately affects low-income minority kids in urban areas. And it's really stemming from a poor housing quality.
Yeah,
and you see this in a lot of public housing as well. So, you know, she was reaching out to legal aid providers weren't able to provide representation because this wasn't an eviction case quite yet. So this was simply an issue of repairs not getting made. They were not coming in to do mold remediation. And so she started building out a case on JustFix ended up having to bring this case to court. And in court, they put together what's called a stipulation, so a negotiated agreement that required mold remediation in the apartment, which was able to happen. You know, these cases can take a little bit of time, so this happened over the course of a few months. But at the end of the day, the mold was removed from the bathroom. You know, there was new plaster, new paint, that type of thing. And I think what's really critical here is, you know, these are not cosmetic issues. These are issues with real health implications for families. And that can be a lifelong health issue that, that could have emerged from that. So it's really important to try to get to these problems as soon as possible.
Absolutely. Well, George Clement, the co-founder and president of Just Fix NYC, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For our listeners to learn more about the organization or get the Just Fix NYC app, what do they need to do?
So they can go to our website, www.justfix.nyc, and sign up directly through there.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, George. It was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.